There. There.
Norris's thoughts turned to Mr. Gaunt. Mr. Gaunt with his silver hair and his tweed and his hungry, jostling smile.
I'm going to get you, Norris Ridgwick whispered. I don't know what happens after that, but I am going to get you so good.
He walked to the shed door, yanked it open, and stepped out into the pouring rain. Unit 2 was parked in the driveway. He bent his thin, Barney Fife body into the wind and walked over to it.
I don't know what you are, Norris said, but I'm coming for your lying, conning ass.
He got into the cruiser and backed down the driveway. Humiliation, misery, and anger were equally at war on his face. At the foot of the driveway, he turned left and began driving toward Needful Things as fast as he dared. Polly Chalmers was dreaming. In her dream, she was walking into Needful Things, but the figure behind the counter was not Leland Gaunt. It was Aunt Evie Chalmers. Aunt Evie was wearing her best blue dress and her blue shawl, the one with the red edging. Gripped between her large and improbably even false teeth was a Herbert Terryden.
Aunt Evie!
Polly cried in her dream. A vast delight and an even vaster relief, the relief we know only in happy dreams and in the moment of waking from horrid ones, filled her like light.
Aunt Evie, you're alive!
But Aunt Evie showed no sign of recognition.
Buy anything you want, miss, Aunt Evie said. By the way, was your name Polly or Patricia? I disremember somehow.
Aunt Evie, you know my name. I'm Tricia. I've always been Tricia to you.
Aunt Evie took no notice. Whatever your name is, we're having a special today. Everything must go.
Aunt Evie, what are you doing here?
I belong here, Aunt Evie said. Everyone in town belongs here, Miss Two Names. In fact, everyone in the world belongs here, because everyone loves a bargain. Everyone loves something for nothing, even if it costs everything.
The good feeling was suddenly gone. Dread replaced it. Polly looked into the glass cases and saw bottles of dark fluid marked Dr. Gaunt's Electric Tonic. There were badly made wind-up toys that would cough up their cogs and spit out their springs the second time they were wound. There were crude sex toys. There were small bottles of what looked like cocaine. These were labeled Dr. Gaunt's Kickapoo Potency Powder. Cheap novelties abounded. Plastic dog puke, itching powder, cigarette loads, joy buzzers. There was a pair of those X-ray glasses that were supposed to allow you to look through closed doors and ladies' dresses, but actually did nothing except put raccoon rings around your eyes. There were plastic flowers and marked playing cards and bottles of cheap perfume marked Dr. Gaunt's Love Potion Number 9 Turns Lassitude into Lust. The cases were a catalog of the timeless, the tasteless, and the useless.
Anything you want, Miss Two Names, Aunt Evie said.
Why are you calling me that, Aunt Evie? Please, don't you recognize me?
It's all guaranteed to work. The only thing not guaranteed to work after the sale is you. So step right up and buy, buy, buy.
Now she looked directly at Polly, and Polly was struck through with terror like a knife. She saw compassion in Aunt Evie's eyes, but it was a terrible, merciless compassion.
What is your name, child? Seems to me I once knew.
In her dream, and in her bed, Polly began to weep.
Has someone else forgotten your name? Aunt Evie asked. I wonder. Seems like they have.
Aunt Evie, you're scaring me.
You're scaring yourself, child, Aunt Evie responded, looking directly at Polly for the first time. Just remember that when you buy here, Miss Two Names, you're also selling.
But I need it, Polly cried. She began to weep harder. My hands!
Yes, this does it, Miss Polly Frisco, Aunt Evie said, and brought out one of the bottles marked Dr. Gaunt's Electric Tonic.
She set it on the counter, a small, squat bottle filled with something that looked like loose mud.
It can't make your pain gone, of course. Nothing can do that, but it can affect a transferal.
What do you mean? Why are you scaring me?
It changes the location of your arthritis, Miss Two Names. Instead of your hands, the disease attacks your heart.
No!
Yes.
No, no, no!
Yes. Oh, yes. And your soul as well. But you'll have your pride. That'll be left to you at least. And isn't a woman entitled to her pride? When everything else is gone? Heart, soul, even the man you love? You'll have that, little Miss Polly Frisco, won't you? You'll have that one coin without which your purse would be empty. Let it be your dark and bitter comfort for the rest of your life. Let it serve. It must serve. Because if you keep on the way you're going, there surely won't be no other.
Stop. Please, can't you?
Stop, she muttered in her sleep. Please, stop. Please. She rolled over on her side. The Oscar chinked softly against its chain. Lightning lit up the sky, striking the elm by Castle Stream, toppling it into the rushing water as Alan Pangborn sat behind the wheel of his station wagon, dazzled by the flash. The follow-shot crack of thunder woke Polly up. Her eyes flew open. Her hand went to the Oscar at once and closed protectively around it. The hand was limber. The joints moved as easily as ball bearings packed in deep, clean oil. Miss Two Names. Little Miss Polly Frisco.
What?
Her voice was thick, but her mind already felt clear and alert, as if she hadn't been asleep at all, but in a daze of thought so deep it was nearly a trance. Something was looming in her mind, something the size of a whale. Outside, lightning flashed and flickered across the sky like bright purple sparklers.
Has someone else forgotten your name? Seems like they have.
She reached for the night table and switched on the lamp. Lying next to the princess phone, the phone equipped with the oversized keypads which she no longer needed, was the envelope she had found lying in the hall with the rest of the mail when she returned home this afternoon. She had refolded the terrible letter and slid it back inside. Somewhere in the night, between the racketing bursts of thunder, she thought she could hear people shouting. Polly ignored them. She was thinking about the cuckoo bird, which lays its egg in a strange nest while the owner is away. When the mother-to-be returns, does she notice that something new has been added? Of course not. She simply accepts it as her own. The way Polly had accepted this goddamned letter simply because it happened to be lying on the hall floor with two catalogs and a come-on from Western Maine Cable TV. She had just accepted it, but anyone could drop a letter through a mail slot. Wasn't that true?
Miss Two Names, she murmured in a dismayed voice. Little Miss Polly Frisco.
And that was the thing, wasn't it? The thing her subconscious had remembered and had manufactured Aunt Evie to tell her. She had been Miss Polly Frisco. Once upon a time, she had. She reached for the envelope.
No,
a voice told her, and that was a voice she knew very well. Don't touch that, Polly. Not if you know what's good for you. Pain as dark and strong as day-old coffee flared deep in her hands. It can't make your pain gone, but it can affect the transferal. That whale-sized thing was coming to the surface. Mr. Gaunt's voice couldn't stop it. Nothing could stop it.
You can stop it, Polly, Mr. Gaunt said. Believe me, you must.
Her hand drew back before it touched the letter. It returned to the Oscar and became a protective fist around it. She could feel something inside it, something which had been warmed by her heat, scurrying frantically inside the hollow silver amulet, and revulsion filled her, making her stomach feel weak and loose, her bowels rotten. She let go and reached for the letter again.
Last warning, Polly, the voice of Mr. Gaunt told her.
Yes, Aunt Ebby's voice replied. I think he means it, Tricia. He has always so enjoyed ladies who take pride in themselves, but do you know what? I don't think he's got much use for those who decide it goeth before a fall. I think the time has come for you to decide once and for all what your name really is. She took hold of the envelope, ignoring another warning twinge in her hands, and looked at the neatly typed address. This letter, purported Xerox, had been sent to Ms. Patricia Chalmers.
No,
she whispered. Wrong. Wrong name. Her hand closed slowly and steadily on the letter, crumpling it. A dull ache filled her fist, but Polly ignored it. Her eyes were bright, feverish. I was always Polly in San Francisco. I was Polly to everyone, even to child welfare. That had been part of her attempt to break clean with every aspect of the old life, which she fancied had hurt her so badly. Never in her darkest nights allowing herself to dream that most of the wounds had been self-inflicted. In San Francisco there had been no Tricia or Patricia, only Polly. She had filled out all three of her ADC applications that way and had signed her name that way, as Polly Chalmers, no middle initial. If Alan really had written to the child welfare people in San Francisco, she supposed he might have given her name as Patricia, but wouldn't any resulting record search have come up blank? Yes, of course. Not even the address would correlate, because the one she'd printed in the space for address of last residence all those years ago had been her parents' address, and that was on the other side of town. Suppose Alan gave them both names, Polly and Patricia. Suppose he had. She knew enough about the workings of government bureaucracies to believe it didn't matter what name or names Alan had given them. When writing to her, the letter would have come to the name and address they had on file. Polly had a friend in Oxford whose correspondence from the University of Maine still came addressed to her maiden name, although she had been married for 20 years. But this envelope had come addressed to Patricia Chalmers, not Polly Chalmers. And who in Castle Rock had called her Patricia just today? The same person who had known that Nettie Cobb was really Natisha Cobb, her good friend Leland Gaunt. All of that about the names is interesting, Aunt Evie said suddenly, but it ain't really the important thing. The important thing is the man, your man. He is your man, ain't he? Even now, you know he would never go behind your back like that letter said he done. Don't matter what name was on it or how convincing it might sound. You know that, don't you? Yes, she whispered. I know him. Had she really believed any of it? Or had she put her doubts about that absurd, unbelievable letter aside because she was afraid, in terror, actually, that Alan would see the nasty truth of the Oscar and force her to make a choice between him and it? Oh, no, that's too simple, she whispered. You believed it, all right. Only for half a day, but you did believe it. Oh, Jesus. Oh, Jesus, what have I done? She tossed the crumpled letter onto the floor with the revolted expression of a woman who has just realized she's holding a dead rat. I didn't tell him what I was angry about. Didn't give him a chance to explain. Just believed it. Why? In God's name, why? She knew, of course. It had been the sudden, shameful fear that her lies about the cause of Kelton's death had been discovered, the misery of her years in San Francisco suspected, her culpability in the death of her baby being evaluated. And all this by the one man in the world whose good opinion she wanted and needed. But that wasn't all of it. That wasn't even most of it. Mostly it had been pride, wounded, outraged, throbbing, swollen, malignant pride. Pride, the coin without which her purse would be entirely empty. She had believed because she had been in a panic of shame, a shame which had been born of pride. I have always so enjoyed ladies who take pride in themselves. A terrible wave of pain broke in her hands. Polly moaned and held them against her breasts. Not too late, Polly, Mr. Gaunt said softly. Not too late, even now. Oh, fuck pride! Polly shrieked suddenly into the dark of her closed, stuffy bedroom and ripped the Oscar from her neck. She held it high overhead in her clenched fist, the fine silver chain whipping wildly, and she felt the surface of the charm crack like the shell of an egg inside her hand. Fuck pride! Pain instantly clawed its way into her hands like some small and hungry animal. But she knew even then that the pain was not as great as she had feared, nowhere near as great as she had feared. She knew it as surely as she knew that Alan had never written to child welfare in San Francisco, asking about her.
Fuck pride! Fuck it! Fuck it! Fuck it! She screamed and threw the Oscar across the room.
It hit the wall, bounced to the floor, and split open. Lightning flashed, and she saw two hairy legs poke out through the crack. The crack widened, and what crawled out was a small spider. It scuttered toward the bathroom. Lightning flashed again, printing its elongated, ovate shadow on the floor like an electric tattoo. Polly leaped from her bed and chased after it. She had to kill it, and quickly, because even as she watched, the spider was swelling. It had been feeding on the poison it had sucked out of her body, and now that it was free of its containment, there was no telling how big it might grow. She slapped the bathroom light switch, and the fluorescent over the sink flickered into life. She saw the spider scurrying toward the tub. When it went through the door, it had been no bigger than a beetle. Now it was the size of a mouse. As she came in, it turned and scurried toward her, that horrid, clittering sound of its legs beating against the tiles. And she had time to think, it was between my breasts. It was lying against me. It was lying against me all the time. Its body was a bristly, blackish brown. Tiny hairs stood out on its legs. Eyes as dull as fake rubies stared at her, and she saw that two fangs stuck out of its mouth like curved vampire teeth. They were dripping some clear liquid. Where the droplets struck the tiles, they left small, smoking craters. Polly screamed and grabbed the bathroom plunger which stood beside the toilet. Her hand screamed back at her, but she closed them about the plunger's wooden handle just the same and struck the spider with it. It retreated, one of its legs now broken and hanging uselessly askew. Polly chased after it as it ran for the tub. Hurt or not, it was still growing. Now it was the size of a rat. Its bulging belly had dragged against the tiles, but it went up the shower curtain with weird agility. Its legs made a sound against the plastic like tiny spats of water. The rings jingled on the steel bar running overhead. Polly swung the plunger like a baseball bat, the heavy rubber cup whooshing through the air, and struck the horrid thing again. The rubber cup covered a lot of area, but was not, unfortunately, very effective when it connected. The shower curtain billowed inward, and the spider dropped off into the tub with a meaty plop. In that instant, the light went out. Polly stood in the dark, the plunger in her hand, and listened to the spider scurrying. Then the lightning flashed again, and she could see its humped, bristly back protruding over the lip of the tub. The thing which had come out of the thimble-sized Oscar was as big as a cat now, the thing which had been nourishing itself on her heart's blood, even as it abstracted the pain from her hands. The envelope I left out at the old Camber place, what was that? With the Oscar no longer around her neck, with the pain awake and yelling in her hands, she could no longer tell herself it had nothing to do with Alan. The spider's fangs clicked on the porcelain edge of the tub. It sounded like someone clicking a penny deliberately on a hard surface for attention. Its listless doll's eyes now regarded her over the lip of the tub. It's too late, those eyes seemed to say. Too late for Alan. Too late for you. Too late for everyone. Polly launched herself at it.
What did you make me do? She screamed. What did you make me do? Oh, you monster! What did you make me do?
And the spider rose up on its rear legs, pawing obscenely at the shower curtain for balance with its front ones to meet her attack. Ace Merrill began to respect the old dude a little when Keaton produced a key which opened the locked shed with the red diamond-shaped high-explosive signs on the door. He began to respect him a little more when he felt the chilly air, heard the steady low whoosh of the air conditioner, and saw the stacked crates. Commercial dynamite. Lots of commercial dynamite. It wasn't quite the same thing as having an arsenal filled with Stinger missiles, but it was close enough for rock and roll. My, yes. There had been a powerful 8-cell flashlight in the carry compartment between the van's front seats, along with a supply of other useful tools, and now, as Alan neared Castle Rock in his station wagon, as Norris Ridgwick sat in his kitchen fashioning a hangman's noose with a length of stout hemp rope, as Polly Chalmers' dream of Aunt Evie moved toward its conclusion, Ace ran the flashlight's bright spotlight from one crate to the next. Overhead, the rain drummed on the shed's roof. It was coming down so hard that Ace could almost believe he was back in the prison showers. "Let's get on with it," Buster said in a low, hoarse voice. "Just a minute, Dad," Ace said. "It's break time." He handed Buster the flashlight and took out the plastic bag Mr. Gaunt had given him. He tipped a little pile of coke into the snuff hollow on his left hand and snorted it quickly. "What's that?" Buster asked suspiciously. "South American bingo dust, and it's just as tasty as taters." "Ha!" Keaton snorted. "Cocaine. They sell cocaine." Ace didn't have to ask who they were. The old dude had talked about nothing else on the ride up here, and Ace suspected he would talk about nothing else all night. "Not true, Dad," Ace said. "They don't sell it. They're the ones who want it all to themselves." He tipped a little more into the snuff hollow at the base of his thumb and held his hand out. "Try it and tell me I'm wrong." Keaton looked at him with a mixture of doubt, curiosity, and suspicion. "Why do you keep calling me Dad? I'm not old enough to be your dad." "Well, I doubt if you ever read the underground comics, but there's this guy named R. Crum," Ace said. The coke was at work in him now, sparking all his nerve endings alight. "He does these comics about a guy named Zippy, and to me, you look just like Zippy's dad." "Is that good?" Buster asked suspiciously. "Awesome," Ace assured him, "but I'll call you Mr. Keaton if you want." He paused and then added deliberately, "Just like they do." "No," Buster said at once, "that's all right, as long as it's not an insult." "Absolutely not," Ace said. "Go on, try it. A little of this shit and you'll be singing hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go until the break of dawn." Buster gave him another look of dark suspicion, then snorted the coke Ace had offered. He coughed, sneezed, then clapped a hand to his nose. His watering eyes stared balefully at Ace. "It burns!" "Only the first time," Ace assured him happily. "Anyway, I don't feel a thing. Let's stop fooling around and get this dynamite into the van." "You bet, Dad." It took them less than 10 minutes to load the crates of dynamite. After they had put the last one in, Buster said, "Maybe that stuff of yours does do something after all. Can I have a little more?" "Sure, Dad," Ace grinned. "I'll join you." They tooted up and headed back to town. Buster drove, and now he began to look not like Zippy's dad, but Mr. Toad in Walt Disney's The Wind in the Willows. A new, frantic light had come into the head selectman's eyes. It was amazing how fast the confusion had dropped out of his mind. He felt he could now understand everything they had been up to, every plan, every plot, every machination. He told Ace all about it as Ace sat in the back of the van with his legs crossed, hooking up hot point timers to blasting caps. For the time being, at least, Buster had forgotten all about Alan Pangborn, who was their ringleader. He was entranced by the idea of blowing Castle Rock, or as much of it as possible, to Kingdom Come. Ace's respect became solid admiration. The old fuck was crazy, and Ace liked crazy people, always had. He felt at home with them. And, like most people on their first cocaine high, old Dad's mind was touring the outer planets. He couldn't shut up. All Ace had to do was keep saying, "Uh-huh," and "That's right, Dad," and "Fucking A, Dad." Several times he almost called Keaton Mr. Toad instead of Dad, but caught himself. Calling this guy Mr. Toad might be a very bad idea. They crossed the tin bridge while Alan was still 3 miles from it and got out in the pouring rain. Ace found a blanket in one of the van's bench compartments and draped it over a bundle of dynamite and one of the cap-equipped timers. "Do you want help?" Buster asked nervously. "You better let me handle it, Dad. You'd be apt to fall in the goddamn stream, and I'd have to waste time fishing you out. Just keep your eyes open, okay?" "I will." "Ace, why don't we sniff a little more of that cocaine first?" Not right now, Ace said indulgently and patted one of Buster's meaty arms. This shit is almost pure. You want to explode?
Not me, Buster said. Everything else, but not me.
He began to laugh wildly. Ace joined him. Having some fun tonight, huh, Dad? Buster was amazed to find this was true. His depression following Myrtle's accident now seemed years distant. He felt that he and his excellent friend Ace Merrill finally had them right where they wanted them, in the palm of their collective hand.
You bet, he said,
and watched Ace slide down the wet, grassy bank beside the bridge with a blanket-wrapped parcel of dynamite held against his belly. It was relatively dry under the bridge. Not that it mattered. Both the dynamite and the blasting caps had been waterproofed. Ace put his package in the elbow crook formed by two of the struts, then attached the blasting cap to the dynamite by poking the wires. The tips were already stripped, how convenient, into one of the sticks. He twisted the big white dial of the timer to 40. It began ticking. He crawled out and scrambled back up the slippery bank.
Well? Buster asked anxiously. Will it blow, do you think?
It'll blow, Ace said reassuringly and climbed into the van. He was soaked to the skin, but he didn't mind.
What if they find it? What if they disconnect it before...
Dad, Ace said, listen a minute. Poke your head out this door and listen. Buster did. Faintly, between blasts of thunder, he thought he could hear yells and screams. Then, clearly, he heard the thin, hard crack of a pistol shot.
Mr. God is keeping them busy, Ace said. He's one clever son of a bitch.
He tipped a pile of cocaine into his snuff hollow, tooted, then held his hand under Buster's nose. Here, Dad, it's Miller time. Buster dipped his head and snorted. They drove away from the bridge about 7 minutes before Alan Pangborn crossed it. Underneath, the timer's black marker stood at 30. Ace Merrill and Danforth Keaton, a.k.a. Buster, a.k.a. Zippy's dad, a.k.a. Toad of Toad Hall, drove slowly up Main Street in the pouring rain like Santa and his helper, leaving little bundles here and there. State police cars roared by them twice, but neither had any interest in what looked like just one more TV news van. As Ace had said, Mr. Gaunt was keeping them busy. They left a timer and 5 sticks of dynamite in the doorway of the Samuels funeral home. The barber shop was beside it. Ace wrapped a piece of blanket around his arm and popped his elbow through the glass pane in the door. He doubted very much if the barber shop was equipped with an alarm, or if the police would bother responding, even if it was. Buster handed him a freshly prepared bomb. They were using wire from one of the bench compartments to bind the timers and the blasting caps securely to the dynamite, and Ace lobbed it through the hole in the door. They watched it tumble to a stop at the foot of the number one chair, the timer ticking down from 25.
Won't nobody be getting a shave in there for a while, Dad? Ace breathed, and Buster giggled breathlessly.
They split up then, Ace tossing one bundle into Galaxia, while Buster crammed another into the mouth of the bank's night deposit slot. As they returned to the van through the slashing rain, lightning ripped across the sky. The elm toppled into Castle Stream with a rending roar. They stood on the sidewalk for a moment, staring in that direction, both of them thinking that the dynamite under the bridge had gone 20 minutes or more early, but there was no blossom of fire.
I think it was lightning, Ace said. Must have hit a tree. Come on.
As they pulled out, Ace driving now, Alan's station wagon passed them. In the pouring rain, neither driver noticed the other. They drove up to Nan's. Ace broke the glass on the door with his elbow, and they left the dynamite and a ticking timer, this one set at 20, just inside, near the cash register stand. As they were leaving, an incredibly bright stroke of lightning flashed, and all the streetlights went out.
It's the power, Buster cried happily. The power's out. Fantastic. Let's do the municipal building. Let's blow it sky high.
Dad, that place is crawling with cops. Didn't you see them?
They're chasing their own tails, Buster said impatiently. And when these things start to go up, they're going to be chasing them twice as fast. Besides, it's dark now, and we can go in through the courthouse on the other side. The master key opens that door, too.
You've got the balls of a tiger, Dad. You know that? Buster smiled tightly.
So do you, Ace. So do you.
Alan pulled into one of the slant parking spaces in front of Needful Things, turned off the station wagon's engine, and simply sat for a moment, staring at Mr. Gaunt's shop. The sign in the window now read, "You say hello, I say goodbye. Goodbye, goodbye. I don't know why you say hello, I say goodbye."
Lightning stuttered on and off like giant neon, giving the window the look of a blank, dead eye.
Yet a deep instinct suggested that Needful Things, while closed and quiet, might not be empty. Mr. Gaunt could have left town in all the confusion, yes. With the storm raging and the cops running around like chickens with their heads cut off, doing that would have been no problem at all. But the picture of Mr. Gaunt, which had formed in his mind on the long, wild ride from the hospital in Bridgeton, was that of Batman's nemesis, the Joker. Alan had an idea that he was dealing with the sort of man who would think installing a jet-powered backflow valve in a friend's toilet the very height of humor. And would a fellow like that, the sort of fellow who would put a tack in your chair or stick a burning match in the sole of your shoe just for laughs, leave before you sat down or noticed that your socks were on fire and your pants cuffs were catching? Of course not. What fun would that be?
I think you're still around, Alan thought. I think you want to watch all the fun, don't you, you son of a bitch?
He sat quite still, looking at the shop with the green awning, trying to fathom the mind of a man who had set such a complex and mean-spirited set of events in motion. He was concentrating far too deeply to notice that the car parked on his left was quite old, although smoothly, almost aerodynamically, designed. It was Mr. Gaunt's Tucker Talisman, in fact. "How did you do it? There's a lot I want to know, but just that one thing will suffice for tonight. How could you do it? How could you learn so much about us so fast?"
Brian said Mr. Gaunt wasn't really a man at all.
In daylight, Alan would have scoffed at this idea, as he had scoffed at the idea that Polly's charm might have some supernatural healing power. But tonight, cupped in the crazy palm of the gale, staring at the display window which had become a blank, dead eye, the idea had its own undeniable, gloomy power. He remembered the day he had come to Needful Things with the specific intention of meeting and talking to Mr. Gaunt, and he remembered the odd sensation that had crept over him as he peered in through the window with his hands cupped at the sides of his face to reduce the glare. He had felt he was being watched, although the shop was clearly empty. And not only that, he had felt the watcher was malign, hateful. The feeling had been so strong that for a moment he had actually mistaken his own reflection for the unpleasant and half-transparent face of someone else. How strong that feeling had been. How very strong. Alan found himself remembering something else, something his grandmother used to tell him when he was small. The devil's voice is sweet to hear. Brian said, "How had Mr. Gaunt come by his knowledge? And why in God's name would he bother with a wide place in the road like Castle Rock? Mr. Gaunt wasn't really a man at all." Alan suddenly leaned over and groped on the floor of the station wagon's passenger side. For a moment, he thought that what he was feeling around for was gone, that it had fallen out of the car at some point during the day when the passenger door was open. And then his fingers happened on the metal curve. It had rolled underneath the seat, that was all. He fumbled it out, held it up, and the voice of depression, absent since he had left Sean Rusk's hospital room, or maybe it was just that things had been too busy since then for Alan to hear it, spoke up in its loud and unsettlingly merry voice.
"Hi, Alan. Hello. I've been away. Sorry about that, but I'm back now, okay? What you got there? Can of nuts? Nope. That's what it looks like, but that's not what it is it? It's the last joke Todd ever bought at the Auburn Novelty Shop, correct? A fake can of Tasty Munch mixed nuts with a green snake inside, crepe paper wrapped around a spring. And when he brought it to you, with his eyes glowing and a big goofy smile on his face, you told him to put that silly thing back, didn't you? And when his face fell, you pretended not to notice. You told him, let me see, what did you tell him?"
that the fool and his money soon parted, Alan said dully. He turned the can around and around in his hands, looking at it, remembering Todd's face. That's what I told him.
Oh, right, the voice agreed. How could I have forgotten a thing like that? You want to talk about mean-spirited? Geez, Louise, good thing you reminded me. Good thing you reminded us both, right? Only Annie saved the day. She said to let him have it. She said, let me see. What did she say?
She said it was sort of funny, that Todd was just like me and that he'd only be young once. Alan's voice was hoarse and trembling. He had begun to cry again, and why not? Just why the fucking hell not? The old pain was back, twisting itself around his aching heart like a dirty rag.
Hurts, doesn't it?
The voice of depression, that guilty, self-hating voice, asked with a sympathy Alan, the rest of Alan, suspected was entirely bogus.
It hurts too much, like having to live inside a country and western song about good love gone bad or good kids gone dead. Nothing that hurts this much can do you any good. Shove it back in the glove compartment, buddy. Forget about it. Next week, when this madness is all over, you can trade the wagon with the fake can of nuts still in it. Why not? It's the sort of cheap, practical joke that would appeal only to a child or to a man like Gaunt. Forget it. Forget.
Alan cut the voice off in mid-rant. He hadn't known he could do that until this moment, and it was good knowledge to have, knowledge that might be useful in the future, if he had a future, that was. He looked more closely at the can, turning it this way and that, really looking at it for the first time, seeing it not as a sappy memento of his lost son, but as an object which was as much a tool of misdirection as his hollow magic wand, his silk top hat with the false bottom, or the folding flower trick, which still nestled beneath his watch band. Magic. Wasn't that what this was all about? It was mean-spirited magic, granted. Magic calculated not to make people gasp and laugh, but to turn them into angry, charging bulls. But it was magic, just the same. And what was the basis of all magic? Misdirection. It was a 5-foot-long snake hidden inside a can of nuts. Or, he thought, thinking of Polly, it's a disease that looks like a cure. He opened the car door, and when he got out into the pouring rain, he was still carrying the fake can of nuts in his left hand. Now that he had drawn back a little from the dangerous lure of sentiment, he remembered his opposition to the purchase of this thing with something like amazement. All his life, he had been fascinated with magic, and of course he would have been entranced by the old snake-in-a-can-of-nuts trick as a kid. So why had he spoken to Todd in such an unfriendly way when the boy had wanted to buy it and then pretended not to see the boy's hurt? Had it been jealousy of Todd's youth and enthusiasm? An inability to remember the wonder of simple things? What? He didn't know. He only knew it was exactly the sort of trick a Mr. Gaunt would understand, and he wanted it with him now. Alan bent back into the car, grabbed a flashlight from the small box of jumbled tools sitting on the rear seat, then walked past the nose of Mr. Gaunt's Tucker talisman, still without noticing it, and passed under the deep green awning of Needful Things. Well, here I am. Here I am at last. Alan's heart was pounding hard but steadily in his chest. In his mind, the faces of his son and his wife and Sean Rusk seemed to have combined. He glanced at the sign in the window again and then tried the door. It was locked. Overhead, the canvas awning rippled and snapped in the howling wind. He had tucked the Tasty Munch can into his shirt. Now he touched it with his right hand and seemed to draw some indescribable but perfectly real comfort from it. Okay, he muttered. Here I come, ready or not. He reversed the flashlight and used the handle to smash a hole in the glass. He steeled himself for the wail of the burglar alarm, but it didn't come. Either Gaunt hadn't turned it on, or there was no alarm. He reached through the jagged hole and tried the inside knob. It turned, and for the first time, Alan Pangborn stepped into Needful Things. The smell hit him first. It was deep and still and dusty. It wasn't the smell of a new shop, but of a place which had been untenanted for months or even years. Holding his gun in his right hand, he shone the flashlight around with his left. It illuminated a bare floor, bare walls, and a number of glass cases. The cases were empty. The stock was gone. Everything was blanketed by a thick fall of dust, and the dust was undisturbed by any mark. No one's been here for a long, long time. But how could that possibly be when he had seen people going in and out all week long? Because he's not a man at all. Because the devil's voice is sweet to hear. He took two more steps, using the flashlight to cover the empty room in zones, breathing the dry museum dust which hung in the air. He looked behind him and saw, in a flash of lightning, the tracks of his own feet in the dust. He shone the light back into the store, ran it from right to left along the case, which had also served Mr. Gaunt as a counter, and stopped. A video cassette recorder player sat there, next to a Sony portable TV, one of the sporty models, round instead of square, with a case as red as a fire engine. A cord was looped around the television, and there was something on top of the VCR. In this light, it looked like a book, but Alan didn't think that was what it was. He walked over and trained his light first on the TV. It was as thickly coated with dust as the floor and the glass cases. The cord looped around it was a short length of coaxial cable with a connector at either end. Alan moved his light to the thing on top of the VCR, the thing which wasn't a book but a video cassette, in an unmarked black plastic case. A dusty white business envelope lay beside it. Written on the front of the envelope was the message, "Attention, Sheriff Alan Pangborn." He set his gun and his flashlight down on the glass counter, took the envelope, opened it, and pulled out the single sheet of paper inside. Then he picked up the flashlight again and trained its powerful circle of light on the short typed message. "Dear Sheriff Pangborn, by now you will have discovered that I am a rather special sort of businessman, the rare sort who actually does try to stock something for everyone. I regret that we were never able to meet face to face, but I hope you'll understand that such a meeting would have been very unwise, from my standpoint at least. Ha ha. In any event, I have left you a little something which I believe will interest you very much. This is not a gift. I am not the Santa Claus type at all, as I think you will agree. But everyone in town has assured me that you are an honorable man, and I believe you will pay the price I require. That price includes a little service, a service which is, in your case, more good deed than prank. I believe you will agree with me, sir. I know you have wondered long and deeply about what happened during the last few moments of your wife and younger son's lives. I believe that all these questions will be answered shortly. Please believe that I wish you only the best, and that I remain your faithful and obedient servant, Leland Gaunt." Alan put the paper down slowly. "Bastard," he muttered. He shone the light around again and saw the VCR's cord trailing down the far side of the case and ending in a plug which lay on the floor several feet from the nearest electric socket, which was no problem since the power was out anyway. "But you know what?" Alan thought. "I don't think that matters. I don't think it matters one little bit. I think that once I hook the appliances up and plug them in and feed that cassette to the tape player, everything is going to work just fine. Because there's no way he could have caused the things he's caused, or know the things he knows, not if he's human. The devil's voice is sweet to hear, Alan, and whatever you do, you must not look at what he's left for you." Nevertheless, he put the flashlight down again and picked up the coaxial cable. He examined it for a moment, then bent to plug it into the proper receptacle on the back of the TV. The tasty munch can tried to slip out of his shirt as he did so. He caught it with one of his nimble hands before it could fall to the floor and set it on the glass case next to the VCR. Norris Ridgwick was halfway to Needful Things when he suddenly decided he would be crazy, much crazier than he had been already, and that was really going some, to tackle Leland Gaunt alone. He pulled the microphone off its prongs. "Unit 2 to base," he said. "This is Norris. Come back." He released the button. There was nothing but a horrid squeal of static. The heart of the storm was directly over the rock now. "Fuck it," he said, and turned toward the municipal building. Alan might be there. If not, someone would tell him where Alan was. Alan would know what to do. And even if he didn't, Alan would have to hear his confession. He had slashed Hugh Priest's tires and sent the man to his death simply because he, Norris Ridgwick, had wanted to own a Basin fishing rod like his good old dad's. He arrived at the municipal building while the timer under the bridge stood at 5 and parked directly behind a bright yellow van, a TV news van from the look. Norris got out in the pouring rain and ran into the sheriff's office to try to find Alan. Polly swung the cup end of the bathroom plunger at the obscenely rearing spider, and this time it did not flinch away. Its bristly front legs clasped the shaft, and Polly's hands cried out in agony as it hauled its quivering weight onto the rubber cup. Her grip wavered, the plunger dropped, and suddenly the spider was scrabbling up the handle like a fat man on a tightrope. She drew in breath to scream, and then its front legs dropped onto her shoulders like the arms of some scabrous dime-a-dance Lothario. Its listless ruby eyes stared into her own. Its fanged mouth dropped open, and she could smell its breath, a stink of bitter spices and rotting meat. She opened her mouth to scream. One of its legs pawed into her mouth. Rough, gruesome bristles caressed her teeth and tongue. The spider mewled eagerly. Polly resisted her first instinct to spit the horrid, pulsing thing out. She released the plunger and grabbed the spider's leg. At the same time, she bit down, using all the strength in her jaws. Something crunched like a mouthful of lifesavers, and a cold, bitter taste like ancient tea filled her mouth. The spider uttered a cry of pain and tried to draw back. Bristles slid harshly through Polly's fists, but she clamped her howling hands tight around the thing's leg again before it could completely escape, and twisted it like a woman trying to twist a drumstick off a turkey. There was a tough, gristly ripping noise. The spider uttered another slobbering cry of pain. It tried to lunge away, spitting out the bitter, dark fluid which had filled her mouth, knowing it would be a long, long time before she was entirely rid of that taste. Polly yanked it back again. Some distant part of her was astounded at this exhibition of strength, but there was another part of her which understood it perfectly. She was afraid, she was revolted, but more than anything else, she was angry. "I was used," she thought incoherently. "I sold Alan's life for this monster." The spider tried to gnash at her with its fangs, but its rear legs lost their tenuous grip on the shaft of the plunger, and it would have fallen if Polly had allowed it to fall. She did not. She gripped its hot, bulging body between her forearms and squeezed. She lifted it up so it squirmed above her, its legs twitching and pawing at her upturned face. Juice and black blood began to run from its body and trickle up her arms in burning streamlets. "No more," shrieked Polly. "No more, no more, no more." She threw it. It struck the tiled wall behind the tub and splattered open in a clod of ichor. It hung up for a moment, pasted in place by its own innards, and then fell into the tub with a gooey thump. Polly grabbed the bathroom plunger again and sprang at it. She began beating it, as a woman might beat at a mouse with a broom, but that wasn't working. The spider only shuddered and tried to crawl away, its legs scrabbling at the rubber shower mat with its pattern of yellow daisies. Polly pulled the plunger back, reversed it, and then rammed forward with all of her strength, using the shaft like a lance. She caught the wretched, freakish thing dead center and impaled it. There was a grotesque punching sound, and then the spider's guts ruptured and ran out onto the shower mat in a stinking flood. It wriggled frantically, curling its legs fruitlessly around the stake she had put in its heart. And then, at last, it became still. Polly stepped back, closed her eyes, and felt the world waver. She had actually begun to faint when Alan's name exploded in her mind like a Roman candle. She curled her hands into fists and brought them together, hard, knuckles to knuckles. The pain was bright, sudden, and immense. The world came back in a cold flash. She opened her eyes, advanced to the tub, and looked in. At first, she thought there was nothing there at all. Then, beside the plunger's rubber cup, she saw the spider. It was no bigger than the nail on her pinky finger, and it was very dead. The rest never happened at all. It was your imagination. The bloody fuck it was, Polly said in a thin, shaking voice. But the spider wasn't the important thing. Alan was the important thing. Alan was in terrible danger, and she was the reason why. She had to find him and do it before it was too late. If it wasn't too late already. She would go to the sheriff's office. Someone there would know where... No, Aunt Evie's voice spoke up in her mind. Not there. If you go there, it really will be too late. You know where to go. You know where he is. Yes. Yes, of course she did. Polly ran for the door, and one confused thought beat at her mind like moth wings. Please, God, don't let him buy anything. Oh, God, please, please, please don't let him buy anything. The timer under Castle Stream Bridge, which had been known as the Tin Bridge to residents of the Rock since time out of mind, reached zero at 7:38 p.m. on the night of Tuesday, October 15th, in the year of our Lord, 1991. The tiny burst of electricity, which was intended to ring the bell, licked across the bare wires Ace had wrapped around the terminals of the 9-volt battery which ran the gadget. The bell actually did begin to ring, but it, and the rest of the timer, was swallowed a split second later in a flash of light as the electricity triggered the blasting cap and the cap in turn triggered the dynamite. Only a few people in Castle Rock mistook the dynamite blast for thunder. The thunder was heavy artillery in the sky. This was a gigantic rifle-shot blast. The south end of the old bridge, which was built not of tin but of old rusty iron, lifted off the bank on a squat ball of fire. It rose perhaps 10 feet into the air, becoming a gently inclined ramp, and then fell back in a bitter crunch of popping cement and the clatter-clang of flying metal. The north end of the bridge twisted loose, and the whole contraption fell askew into Castle Stream, which was now in full spate. The south end came to rest on the lightning-downed elm. On Castle Avenue, where the Catholics and the Baptists, along with nearly a dozen state policemen, were still locked in strenuous debate, the fighting paused. All the combatants stared toward the fire rose at the Castle Stream end of town. Albert Gendron and Phil Bergmeier, who had been duking it out with great ferocity seconds before, now stood side by side, looking into the glare. Blood was running down the left side of Albert's face from a temple wound, and Phil's shirt was mostly torn off. Nearby, Nan Roberts squatted atop Father Brigham like a very large, and, in her rayon waitress's uniform, very white, vulture. She had been using his hair to raise the good father's head and slam it repeatedly into the pavement. Reverend Rose lay close by, unconscious as a result of Father Brigham's ministrations. Henry Peyton, who had lost a tooth since his arrival, not to mention any illusions he might once have had about religious harmony in America, froze in the act of pulling Tony Mislaburski off Baptist deacon Fred Mellon. They all froze, like children playing statues. Jesus Christ, that was the bridge, Don Hemphill muttered. Henry Peyton decided to take advantage of the lull. He tossed Tony Mislaburski aside, cupped his hands around his wounded mouth, and bawled, "All right, everybody, this is the police. I'm ordering you." Then Nan Roberts raised her voice in a shout. She had spent many long years bawling orders into the kitchen of her diner, and she was used to being heard no matter how stiff the racket was. It was no contest. Her voice overtopped Peyton's easily. "The goddamn Catholics are using dynamite," she bugled. There were fewer participants now, but what they lacked in numbers, they made up for in angry enthusiasm. Seconds after Nan's cry, the rumble was on again, now spreading into a dozen skirmishes along a 50-yard stretch of the rain-swept avenue. Norris Ridgwick burst into the sheriff's office moments before the bridge went, yelling at the top of his lungs, "Where's Sheriff Pangborn? I've got to find Sheriff Pa..." He stopped. Except for Seton Thomas and a state cop who didn't look old enough to drink beer yet, the office was deserted. Where the hell was everybody? There were, it seemed, about 6,000 state police units and other assorted vehicles parked helter-skelter outside. One of them was his own VW, which would easily have won the blue ribbon for helter-skelter had ribbons been awarded. It was still lying on its side where Buster had tipped it.
"Jesus!" Norris cried. "Where is everybody?"
The state cop, who didn't look old enough to drink beer yet, took in Norris's uniform and then said, "There's a brawl going on upstreet somewhere. The Christians against the cannibals or some damn thing. I'm supposed to be monitoring and dispatch, but with this storm I can't transmit or receive Doodly Squad." He added morosely, "Who are you?"
"Deputy Sheriff Ridgewick."
"Well, I'm Joe Price. What kind of town have you got here anyhow, Deputy? Everyone in it has gone stone crazy." Norris ignored him and went to Seaton Thomas. Seat's complexion was dirty gray, and he was breathing with great difficulty. One of his wrinkled hands was pressed squarely in the middle of his chest.
"Seat, where's Allen?"
"Dunno," Seat said, looking at Norris with dull, frightened eyes. "Something bad's happening, Norris. Really bad. All over town. The phones are out, and that shouldn't be because most of the lines are underground now. But do you know something? I'm glad they're out. I'm glad because I don't want to know."
"You should be in the hospital," Norris said, looking at the old man with concern.
"I should be in Kansas," Seat said drearily. "Meantime, I'm just going to sit here and wait for it to be over. I ain't..."
The bridge blew up then, cutting him off. That great rifle-shot noise ripped the night like a claw.
"Jesus!" Norris and Joe Price cried out in unison.
"Yep," Seat Thomas said in his weary, frightened, nagging, unsurprised voice. "They're gonna blow up the town, I guess. I guess that comes next."
Suddenly, shockingly, the old man began to weep.
"Where's Henry Payton?" Norris shouted at Trooper Price.
Price ignored him. He was running for the door to see what had blown up.
Norris spared a glance at Seaton Thomas, but Seat was staring gloomily out into space, tears rolling down his face and his hand still planted squarely in the center of his chest.
Norris followed Trooper Joe Price and found him in the municipal building parking lot, where Norris had ticketed Buster Keaton's red Cadillac about 1,000 years ago. A pillar of dying fire stood out clearly in the rainy night, and in its glow, both of them could see that the Castle Stream Bridge was gone. The traffic light at the far end of town had been knocked into the street.
"Mother of God," Trooper Price said in a reverent voice, "I'm sure glad this isn't my town."
The firelight had put roses on his cheeks and embers in his eyes. Norris's urge to locate Allen had deepened. He decided he had better get back in his cruiser and try to find Henry Payton first. If there was some sort of big brawl going on, that shouldn't be too difficult. Allen might be there, too. He was almost across the sidewalk when a stroke of lightning showed him two figures trotting around the corner of the courthouse next to the municipal building. They appeared to be heading for the bright yellow news van. One of them he was not sure of, but the other figure, portly and a little bow-legged, was impossible to mistake. It was Danforth Keaton. Norris Ridgewick took two steps to the right and planted his back against the brick wall at the mouth of the alley. He drew his service revolver. He raised it to shoulder level, its muzzle pointing up into the rainy sky, and screamed, "Halt!" at the top of his lungs. Polly backed her car down the driveway, switched on the windshield wipers, and made a left turn. The pain in her hands had been joined by a deep, heavy burning in her arms, where the spider's muck had fallen on her skin. It had poisoned her somehow, and the poison seemed to be working its way steadily into her. But there was no time to worry about it now. She was approaching the stop sign at Ford and Main when the bridge went up. She winced away from that massive rifle shot and stared for a moment, amazed, at the bright gout of flame which rose up from Castle Stream. For a moment she saw the gantry-like silhouette of the bridge itself, all black angles against the strenuous light, and then it was swallowed in flame. She turned left again onto Main, in the direction of Needful Things. At one time, Alan Pangborn had been a dedicated maker of home movies. He had no idea how many people he had bored to tears with jumpy films projected on a sheet tacked to the living room wall, of his diapered children toddling their uncertain way about the living room, of Annie giving them baths, of birthday parties, of family outings. In all these films, people waved and mugged at the camera. It was as though there were some sort of unspoken law. When someone points a movie camera at you, you must wave or mug or both. If you do not, you may be arrested on a charge of second-degree indifference, which carries a penalty of up to 10 years, said time to be spent watching endless reels of jumpy home movies. 5 years ago, he had switched to a video camera, which was both cheaper and easier, and instead of boring people to tears for 10 or 15 minutes, which was the length of time 3 or 4 rolls of 8mm film ran when spliced together, you could bore them for hours, all without even plugging in a fresh cassette. He took this cassette out of its box and looked at it. There was no label. Okay, he thought, that's perfectly okay. I'll just have to find out what's on it for myself, won't I? His hand moved to the VCR's on button, and there it hesitated. The composite formed by Todd's and Sean's and his wife's faces retreated suddenly. It was replaced by the pallid, shocked face of Brian Rusk, as Alan had seen him just this afternoon. You look unhappy, Brian.
Yes, sir.
Does that mean you are unhappy?
Yes, sir. And if you turn that switch, you'll be unhappy, too. He wants you to look at it, but not because he wants to do you a favor. Mr. Gaunt doesn't do favors. He wants to poison you, that's all, just like he's poisoned everyone else.
Yet he had to look. His fingers touched the button, caressed its smooth, square shape. He paused and looked around. Yes, Gaunt was still here, somewhere. Alan could feel him, a heavy presence, both menacing and cajoling. He thought of the note Mr. Gaunt had left behind. I know you have wondered long and deeply about what happened during the last few moments of your wife and younger son's lives. Don't do it, Sheriff, Brian Rusk whispered. Alan saw that pallid, hurt, pre-suicidal face looking at him from above the cooler in his bike basket, the cooler filled with the baseball cards. Let the past sleep. It's better that way. And he lies. You know he lies. Yes, he did. He did know that. Yet, he had to look. Alan's finger pushed the button. The small green power light went on at once. The VCR worked just fine, power outage or no power outage, just as Alan had known it would. He turned on the sexy red Sony, and in a moment, the bright white glow of Channel 3 snow lit his face with pallid light. Alan pushed the eject button, and the VCR's cassette carrier popped up. Don't do it, Brian Rusk's voice whispered again, but Alan didn't listen. He carted the cassette, pushed the carrier down, and listened to the little mechanical clicks as the heads engaged the tape. Then he took a deep breath and pushed the play button. The bright white snow on the screen was replaced by smooth blackness. A moment later, the screen went slate gray and a series of numbers flashed up. 8-7-6-5-4-3-2-X. What followed was a shaky, handheld shot of a country road. In the foreground, slightly out of focus but still readable, was a road sign. 117, it said, but Alan didn't need it. He had driven that stretch many times and knew it well. He recognized the grove of pines just beyond the place where the road curved. It was the grove where the scout had fetched up, its nose crumpled around the largest tree in a jagged embrace. But the trees in this picture showed no scars of the accident, although the scars were still visible if you went out there and looked. He had many times. Wonder and terror slipped silently into Alan's bones as he realized, not just from the unwounded surfaces of the trees and the curve in the road, but from every configuration of the landscape and every intuition of his heart, that this videotape had been shot on the day Annie and Todd had died. He was going to see it happen. It was quite impossible, but it was true. He was going to see his wife and son smashed open before his very eyes. Turn it off, Brian screamed. Turn it off. He's a poison man, and he sells poison things. Turn it off before it's too late. But Alan could have done this no more than he could have stilled his own heartbeat by thought alone. He was frozen, caught. Now the camera panned jerkily to the left, up the road. For a moment there was nothing, and then there was a sun twinkle of light. It was the scout. The scout was coming. The scout was on its way to the pine tree where it and the people inside it would end forever. The scout was approaching its terminal point on Earth. It was not speeding. It was not moving erratically. There was no sign that Annie had lost control or was in danger of losing it. Alan leaned forward beside the humming VCR, sweat trickling down his cheeks, blood beating heavily in his temples. He felt his gorge rising. This isn't real. It's a put-up job. He had it made somehow. It's not them. There may be an actress and a young actor inside pretending to be them, but it's not them. It can't be. Yet he knew it was. What else would you see in images transmitted by a VCR to a TV which wasn't plugged in but worked anyway? What else but the truth? A lie! Brian Rusk's voice cried out, but it was distant and easily ignored. A lie, Sheriff! A lie! A lie! Now he could see the license plate on the approaching scout. 24912V, Annie's license plate. Suddenly, behind the scout, Alan saw another twinkle of light. Another car, approaching fast, closing the distance. Outside, the tin bridge blew up with that monstrous rifle crack sound. Alan didn't look in that direction, didn't even hear it. Every ounce of his concentration was fixed on the screen of the red Sony TV, where Annie and Todd were approaching the tree which stood between them and all the rest of their lives. The car behind them was doing 70, maybe 80 miles an hour. As the scout approached the cameraman's position, this second car, of which there had never been any report, approached the scout. Annie apparently saw it, too. The scout began to speed up, but it was too little, and it was too late. The second car was a lime-green Dodge Challenger, jacked in the back, so the nose pointed at the road. Through the smoked-glass windows, one could dimly make out the roll bar arching across the roof inside. The rear end was covered with stickers. Hearst, Fuley, Fram, Quaker State Oil. Although the tape was silent, Alan could almost hear the blast and crackle of exhaust through the straight pipes. Ace! He cried out in agonized comprehension. Ace! Ace Merrill! Revenge! Of course! Why had he never thought of it before? The scout passed in front of the camera, which panned right to follow. Alan had one moment when he could see inside, and yes, it was Annie, the paisley scarf she had been wearing that day tied in her hair, and Todd in his Star Trek T-shirt. Todd was looking back at the car behind him. Annie was looking up into the rearview mirror. He could not see her face, but her body was leaning tensely forward in the seat, pulling her shoulder harness taut. He had that one brief last look at them, his wife and his son, and part of him realized he did not want to see them this way if there was no hope of changing the result. He did not want to see the terror of their last moments. But there was no going back now. The Challenger bumped the scout. It wasn't a hard hit, but Annie had sped up, and it was hard enough. The scout missed the curve and veered off the road and toward the grove of trees where the large pine waited.
No!
Alan shouted. The scout jounced into the ditch and out of it. It rocked up on two wheels, came back down, and smashed into the bole of the pine tree with a soundless crunch. A rag doll with a paisley scarf in its hair flew through the windshield, struck a tree, and bounced into the underbrush. The lime-green Challenger stopped at the edge of the road. The driver's door opened. Ace Merrill got out. He was looking toward the wreck of the scout, now barely visible in the steam escaping its ruptured radiator, and he was laughing.
No!
Alan screamed again, and pushed the VCR over the side of the glass case with both hands. It struck the floor, but it didn't break, and the coaxial cord was just a little too long to pull out. A line of static ran across the TV